You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan.
This week, the indie filmmakers behind Transformer.
You know, it's tough being vulnerable, but at the same time, if I'm not willing to be open and honest and talk about the things that are really troubling for me, how can I help educate and inspire people if I'm not willing to do that?
Don't talk to Irene.
And I really knew that if she didn't nail the audition, we didn't have a movie.
And Mr. Fish, cartooning from the deep end.
Real satire, it doesn't throw you a life preserver, it teaches you how to swim.
Discuss their journey from initial concept to ultimately producing their award-winning films.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan.
We begin the show with last year's powerful documentary feature jury award and Hiscox Insurance Award winner, Transformer. Written and directed by Michael Del Monte, the film follows former U.S. Marine and world record powerlifter Matt Krozaleski as he sets out to become a woman. Outed as being transgender and banned from competition, Janae attempts to find her place in society. Film competition director Harrison Glazer spoke with Del Monte and Janae at a special screening of the film hosted at the Alamo Drafthouse Village earlier this year. Clips and trailer of Transformer, courtesy of Michael Del Monte and StoryStream Creative.
I want my boys to be able to be proud of me.
I don't think I'm comfortable as an extremely muscular woman, but as a guy, that's the only way I'm comfortable.
Let's go, man. Come on.
Well, there's just this feeling of being pulled between two worlds.
Michael, do you want to talk about how you met Janae and why was this a story you want to tell? And then Janae, why you said yes?
I'd been doing a bunch of work filming in the muscle space. I'd always been interested in why men have a desire to kind of shape and mold their body with muscle in an attempt to make themselves more courageous or appear more strong. So I'd been following that for a while, and then a colleague of mine who had been filming with Janae's former supplement company contacted me and said, you should see this story. This person was strongest man in the world and was just outed. So I got in touch with Janae and drove 5 hours from Toronto to Ypsilanti. We talked for an entire night without a camera and just kind of got to know one another, talked about why I wanted to do it, you know, what my hope of the film would be, and she said, for whatever reasons,
yes. No, I mean, my biggest concern going into it was that it was going to be, you know, represented honestly and openly, and it wasn't going to be sensationalized. That was a big concern of mine. After I was outed, I did a bunch of interviews and podcasts and a few TV spots and like TMZ, Inside Edition, stuff like that. And some of it was sensationalized. And so I knew early on right away I had to be very careful about how things were going to be presented. And also I explained to Michael, like, the first, you know, that first night, that I said, look, you know, I'm not interested in being a reality TV star or anything like that. I said, there's only really two goals I have for this, and it's to hopefully inspire people like me and help educate people that don't understand. If we can do both of those things, then I'm 100% for it. And I was really, you know, interested in getting to know Michael better, and just, but the vibe I got from him right off the start was that he was honest and he was sincere and that he would do a good job telling my story. And as you guys can see, he did. He did an excellent job, and I really appreciate it.
Michael, I'm curious how you crafted the story, so where the story started and where it led. Did your idea of what the story was going to be evolve as you were shooting more and more of Janae?
I obviously had no idea how it was going to end. The only thing I knew was that she was going to have a hell of a time losing the muscle. I'd heard interviews of her saying, you know, my first step is to lose this muscle because I want to appear, and I knew once you have muscle, you don't lose it. It's like a banker on Wall Street. They don't want a smaller portfolio. They want a bigger one. And muscle is a very hard thing to build. It's, you know, it takes time, it takes money, it takes effort. And someone doesn't just willfully lose it. And particularly in someone's case like Janae, you know, muscle was like a cape, you know, for a superhero, right? It was like a protection, it was an identity, it was a strength, and you don't just give that up. And so all I knew from the start was this was not going to be easy, and I would love to see how this goes.
Janae, I mean, you were so vulnerable in this capture, some of your most vulnerable moments. What was it like watching it for the first time? Did, like, that distance give you any sort of new perspective or take on your own life?
This isn't scripted. We didn't come in there with a bias or an angle or be like, well, let's talk about this stuff. This was my life. And, you know, Michael just did a great job of capturing that and portraying it. And it's not easy. It's not easy to watch it and watch yourself. And I tend to be overly self-critical anyway. So it's kind of like sometimes some of the scenes that make me cringe. I'm like, ugh, what was I thinking when I wore that? but for me, I just tried to forget about, like, the cameras being there and just be myself. And fortunately, like, I joke about this often, that my success in powerlifting prepared me very well for getting into activism and coming out as being transgender. I was already used to being in front of a camera. I was used to being interviewed. And the funny thing was, actually, I had to remind myself that there was a mic on me 24/7 and there were cameras. Michael and the crew became my friends. And so it was just like hanging out with your buddies and being you and, you know, doing your thing. But, you know, it's tough being vulnerable. But at the same time, how can I expect anyone to understand if I'm not willing to share those things, if I'm not willing to be open and honest and vulnerable and talk about the things that are really troubling for me? How can I help educate and inspire people if I'm not willing to do that?
This is such a great edit, and it feels like such a cohesive piece, but I imagine in doing so, there were moments that you had to let go of or that we couldn't include.
You have to make the best decisions you can, and there's always going to be some sacrifices. You lose things here and there. I think in particular, there were some moments with the boys. There was that moment when you all went for breakfast on Christmas and trying to figure out what do we call you now?
What do they call you now?
Honestly, it varies. I don't really, I've never pressured the boys to call me anything or address me a certain way. We just talked about, you know, like if we're out in public and there's other people around and I'm presenting, you know, in a feminine manner, if they do call me dad, then it's going to draw people's attention and it might make things more awkward. But to them, I'm just like, whatever you guys feel comfortable with. And to be honest, sometimes they call me dad and sometimes they call me mom. And for me, it's more about the intent. And so, like, if someone was misgendering me intentionally and doing it to insult me, yeah, that's going to bother me. Mm-hmm. But if it's an accident or they just don't understand, I try to be open-minded and you know, understand that. And if it's not meant in an offensive way, I don't take offense. But with my boys, it's, you know, like I said, I've never pressured them one way or the other. That was something I tried to be very conscious of. My gender is still a bit fluid. Some days I present more masculine, some days more feminine. You know, some days when I'm getting up every morning at 4 a.m. to do my makeup, I'm like, did I really, really want this? You know? But, and obviously, I'm still not a stereotypical woman. I'm still walking around at 235, 240 pounds of muscle, and I'm comfortable with that. Really, what I try to focus on now is just being me. I try not to think about gender. I try not to think about sex. I just try to think about what makes me happy and do that. And if people understand, great. And if they don't understand, that's okay, too.
And were there other parts of the movie that you were kind of hoping to see or that really great moments caught on camera?
Honestly, all the moments with the boys. I mean, for me, there could have been a 5-hour film all about the boys, and I would have been happy with that. But I thought that Michael chose some of the very best scenes. The one in the pool where we're doing the chicken fighting and I'm on top of Logan, that cracks me up every time. And actually, I'm really thankful that they captured all these moments and we'll have them for, you know, forever. Yeah. Because there's so many things you do every day when the kids are growing up and you don't capture it and you wish you had it. For 2 years, there's all these special moments that were captured and we'll always have. So it's pretty awesome. But I think for the time allotted, they did an amazing job, you know, picking the important pieces and making it all flow together. And because it's hard. I mean, it was, you know, 2 years of me back and forth. And, you know, like I said, at one point, I'm like, oh, I think I've tried to transition 5 times. Well, maybe it was 8 times. Maybe it was. And then it kind of gets into this blur where what is transition for me, you know? Mm-hmm.
Every time we canoe, he's like this. He likes to play.
I wasn't ready to go.
He's never, you know, he's always been in any kind of sport, always played with the big boys, you know, played ball, you know, everything they've done when they were kids, everything I've ever done with them, you know, it's always been the macho shit, you know. It's a total shock to me. I still don't believe it, don't really agree with it, but what he wants to do, I can't talk him out of it. If that's his decision, well, you know, not much I can do about it. I don't, like I said, I don't think it's right, but he's not going to listen to me.
My dad's a simple guy. He's, you know, for lack of a better term, he's very redneck. And my dad hasn't known as long. He was like actually the last person I told. A lot of my friends and family knew long before he did. It was just a conversation that was difficult to have with him. But the thing that made me feel good about my dad was when I first told him, and you know, he kind of the same reaction he had there. And sometimes I feel like he also feels like he has to have a problem with it, you know, being the rural town and you know, still trying to kind of be like tough guy, old school macho or whatever. Like I think he feels almost pressure that he's not supposed to be okay with it. The only thing that didn't make me feel good is the first time I told him, after he said a bunch of other stuff about, you know, don't do it, it's a mistake and you'll regret it, but he did say, no matter what, I still want you in my life. And that was really good to hear. So that, with everything else he said, that was enough for me to realize, like, deep down, he's still, you know, still in his own way. But it'd be nice if, you know, he was a little more comfortable with it. And maybe in time he will be, I don't know. Yeah. But my mom is, it's difficult because I told her a long time ago, and I still can't even have a conversation with her about it. If I try to bring it up, she immediately switches the subject, and it's just, we can't talk. But that's my mom's natural coping mechanism, avoidance. Not a good one, but that's hers. And it's also hard for my parents, because they still live in the small town where I grew up at. And because of my success in powerlifting, and because of like guarding the president and the Marines and those things, small town, everybody knows that. So prior to my coming out, I was like this hometown hero. I had been told there were posters of me hanging up in the high school and stuff like that. So with transition, that also made it really, really hard because I felt all this pressure to keep up this image. Everyone had kind of put me up on this pedestal, even my friends and family. And it was really hard for me to be open and honest because I was like, you guys have no idea who I am. You know, you really don't. Like, as a parent myself, I mean, you can see the relationship I have with my boys, and maybe it's easier, maybe I'm biased because of, you know, being the way I am, maybe it's easy for me to be more accepting. It's hard for me to understand as a parent how you can't support your child. You know, I'll never understand that. So for her to be more worried about what other people in the family think than how I feel, it's painful.
Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan.
We're back with Transformer. Written and directed by Michael Del Monte, the film follows former U.S. Marine and world record powerlifter Matt Krozaleski as he sets out to become a woman. Outed as being transgender and banned from competition, Janae attempts to find her place in society.
Have they watched the movie, or are they interested in watching this?
They have not. I think it'd be difficult for my parents to watch it and see it. You saw in the film, like, as much as I tried to make my mom more comfortable, she couldn't even look at me.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's changed. Yeah. You know, my dad, the same thing. And my dad would, I don't know. He might start to watch it and get up and walk out. I don't know. I would definitely encourage them to do so. Maybe it'll help them understand. And and maybe just seeing themselves and how they reacted, and maybe make them reflect a little more. But we're all adults, and how they feel is how they feel, and you know, they're entitled to that.
I wanted to touch on this quickly for both you and Michael. I think the reason we love this film is it's not just a quote trans film or LGBT film. It's a film about a person who happens to be trans. In making this film, was that just something that kind of happened, or was that a conscious effort to make this? I guess apolitical maybe is not the best word, but not an agenda.
Yeah, that was definitely, you know, part of the conversation we had on that first night, was just to say, you know, I can openly say I'm not personally in the LGBT world, but, and I thought that was an important advantage to tell this story, because I wasn't approaching it with a bias, but it's very hard not to approach something with a bias when you're part of that community or any community. It was good to approach this not with an agenda, but rather as a filmmaker looking to tell a great story. You have a great character about to go, you know, on an incredible journey, and that was the most important thing. I remember one thing we said was that we wanted to reach people who would not otherwise watch this type of film. Can we make something that has appeal for different reasons, you know, and for the integrity of the story?
I think really what the story is about, and we had talked about this out there too, is that it's just about someone trying to be who they are, trying to find themselves and be honest, the most honest and real version of who they are. And granted, you know, for me, that's a little more difficult just because of current society and who I am. But really, it's, I think we all can relate to that. We all have parts of ourselves that we aren't happy with, or we wish were different, and things we hide, and that we're afraid to be vulnerable and afraid to be open. And you know, for 23 years of my life, I never told a single soul. I was terrified of what people would think if they found out. And we all kind of feel that way. There's little bits we hide away, and we'd be embarrassed or feel too vulnerable if we let other people see that. So it's just a struggle to be yourself, and I think we all can relate to that.
Next up, our 2017 Comedy Vanguard Feature Jury and Audience Award winner, Don't Talk to Irene. Written and directed by Pat Mills, Don't Talk to Irene is Mills' second feature. The film's script first won Austin Film Festival's Best Comedy Screenplay Competition in 2013 and follows Irene, an unpopular student, as she gets suspended and endures 2 weeks of community service at a retirement home. Mills sat down with me to discuss the film at a special screening hosted earlier this year at the Alamo Drafthouse Village. Clips of Don't Talk to Irene, courtesy of Patrick Mills, Lithium Studios, Allison Richards Productions, and Gravitas Ventures.
What inspired this story for you, and when did you feel like that script was ready to submit?
Well, a lot of different things inspired the movie, but the very kernel of the idea is when I went to a place called North Bay, Ontario, which is 5 hours north of Toronto, but I saw this girl who's dressed in pink biking all weekend long when I was there, and I would see her everywhere. I'm like, who the hell is she? I want to know what her story is. So that was the birth of the character. And then when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time in nursing homes because my grandmother was sick. So I would go to a nursing home and I would be bored, because kids are bored in nursing homes. And I would kind of walk down the halls on my own, and I would interact with these older people. And so I think that always affected me when I was a kid. And then just, I love teen movies. Mm-hmm. I love dark comedies, and I love dancing, and I love movies about dancing. So just putting all those together into one one idea is really what made the script.
So Irene, she's so infectious. You found this incredible person to play her. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the process of actually finding that person? It had to be quite a search, and how you knew when you had the right person, and tell us a little bit about her.
So the search for Irene was really tough, and we all knew it was gonna be tough, but I didn't want to change the script to get somebody that would fit easily gettable body type. Like, it was really important to me that she didn't fit in, and she was a bit different. And so we had to push the shoot 2 or 3 times because we searched all over Canada and we couldn't find her. And we knew if we didn't find her, the movie wouldn't work. So we ended up getting an American casting director to do an American casting call. And then we had this self-tape come in, and it was Michelle McLeod who played Irene, and we thought that she was American because she had been submitted to the American casting call. And she, because it was an American casting call, she thought it was an American production. So we asked her for another self-tape, and then it turns out we both found out we were in the same city, so we could meet in person. And I really knew that if she didn't nail the audition, we didn't have a movie. It was our last chance. And I really wanted her to do well, so I took her out for coffee before her audition and gave her a list of movies to watch. Mm-hmm. And really, I wanted to hear if she had any stories that she could relate to the character. So I just wanted her to like make it real, but then watch these fun movies like Superstar and Welcome to the Dollhouse and Election and Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion and all these kind of fun, kind of broad comedies. But I wanted it to be a grounded performance. And she was amazing. And it was her first movie role. She had done a web series before, and she was doing Second City shows. Uh-huh. So she does a lot of sketch comedy, and she still does in Toronto, and she's really, really fun. I've seen her live, and she's really fun and really talented.
The cast in general actually was really great. Can you give us a little background on some of them, especially Sarah or that which I believe she got called more than her name.
Her name is Aviva Mongillo, and she was on a show in Canada called Backstage. And she's just starting out, and she's also a pop singer, and she's really talented. And a lot of the younger cast, Robbie, her friend, the boyfriend in the movie, hadn't done anything else. And then it was fun to see these people like Michelle, Aviva, and Romeo, he's Robbie, act with these people who have a lot of experience. So the older actors are, you know, seasoned theater and film and television Canadian actors that we were able to assemble. So it was really fun to see them interact with these people who have a lot of experience. And then, you know, people like Scott Thompson, who obviously has a lot of experience. It was kind of fun just putting all these people with no experience together with these people who have too much experience and just see what happens.
Directing your script, I mean, is that a frightening process a little bit when you're throwing people in there that haven't had that experience before?
It can be a little challenging because I always like to go off script and improv and kind of get them to act the intention of the scene, not necessarily the literal scene as written. And some people are really good at it and some people aren't. So when you put them in the scene together, it's like somebody's making it work and the other one's like deer in the headlights because they're terrified and they've never done it before. I think that it's in some ways easier directing your own script because you know what you're intending. You know what the scene should be as the writer, and it's easy to direct that rather than directing, you know, somebody else's words.
So let's talk about Gina Davis, how that all came about.
Well, once we had Michelle, we knew we needed to find our God. And Gina Davis was, I had different versions of the script. So I was like, we're going to go after Gina. If Gina doesn't say no, we have this version and this version and this version. And then it would, like, the quality of the person would go. It did create a whole new draft if she were to say no. So it was really, I was really happy to hear that she did say yes. And essentially what I had done was I wrote her a letter. And I sent the script, and our casting director sent it to her. And then a week later, I got this email from the casting director saying, Gina would like to talk to you. Stick by your phone. She'll call you at some point today. And I was like, oh God, this is going to be... I went in and I bought a pack of cigarettes, and I just like chain smoked, waiting for Gina Davis to call. And then she did. And she was like, hello, Matt, it's Gina Davis, in her very iconic voice. And we had a really good conversation for about half an hour, and she had questions about how I was going to handle the script, and, you know, she thought it was really funny. She specifically just wanted to know, like, what tone it was going to be. Mm-hmm. And then she's like, well, I guess I have to talk to my agent. And then so I found out a week later, which was a long time, and then she signed on. Uh-huh. So what we did is we flew Michelle to Los Angeles to shoot the scene with her, and she was just really lovely and no ego. I was like, could you put on this purple leotard? And no problem. So she was great.
What were those movies you watched? You know, the ones you just talked about that you had Irene watch. But what were the movies you watched? What inspired you?
I haven't mentioned the dance movies that I really liked. So like Dirty Dancing, I always loved because Baby's so relatable to so many people. Like she's sort of an underdog and she's awkward, but she grows and she becomes this like confident person during the movie. And I always kind of loved that. And Girls Just Wanna Have Fun is another fun, like silly dance movie, but like a dance show. So those inspired it, but also like documentaries like Young at Heart, which is exploring retirement home and people who form these like choirs and they sing like pop music. Not in terms of a movie, but I was following a senior dance troupe just outside of Toronto called the Burlington Footnotes. And it's a 65 plus dance troupe of like maybe 50 people. And they make their own clothes, which is like sequined outfits with top hats. And they do choreographed dance to like Justin Timberlake songs. So they were pretty cool. So they inspired it as well. I mean, I love Welcome to the Dollhouse, but I wrote the first draft of this in 2009. I submitted to the Austin Film Festival in 2013. And we shot it last year. So it did take a long time and it would change constantly because another thing that happens is like the script that I submitted, we couldn't afford a lot of the things that are in there. So I have to do continuously revising the screenplay. And sometimes you're like, what? We can't afford that. And we had to cut an entire character because we didn't afford it. And so it's, you're constantly rewriting even on the day when you're shooting because things just don't work. So it's kind of hard to really pinpoint exactly, but it takes a long time and it's constant work. I think we were all, like producers and me, were all a bit, we wanted to protect Irene and give her a sweeter story. Because that first draft was really severe and it went to dark, dark places. And I feel like, let's put Irene in a more like sunshiny movie rather than a movie with a murder subplot. That was the first draft. Things change.
Some of the best moments are these moments with Irene where some great line comes out that you're not expecting and she's snappy and smart, but very unexpected.
In my writing, it's always veers like comedic for sure, but I never had any formal, like I was never confident enough to go to improv in high school or anything. So I never really got into that world, although I should have. It's one of my regrets. Like, but yeah, everything that I've always done has always been a bit comedic.
Okay, my favorite scene is the meat scene.
Why are you giving me this piece of meat, woman?
They need self-awareness. Do it.
Eat it. Pick up the meat and put it in your mouth. Chew it. Now, smile at them. Big smile, lots of teeth. Now they know you're tough.
That's just so brilliant. I mean, it's just very unexpected. Did that happen to you? Do you know anybody that happened to? Can you talk about that? Did it happen to you in the old folks' home? So.
It happened to me, yeah. This kid who was a bully of mine who lived on my street, like threw luncheon meat. It was like ham that had macaroni and like processed cheese like embedded into the meat, and it hit my face. This kid also vomited on my hair on purpose, so. I got that performance because Bruce gave it to me. It was like one of those actors where who say you get your performance from the other actor. And so I knew that was a big, we had to nail that. So we did schedule the day around taking a long time to do that because I wanted real tears. But the problem, which we didn't count on, bad aim. We had a specific meat wrangler who, but he was terrible at pitching. So then we got somebody else to try it, and nobody could nail it. And she would get ready and get into the like, okay, I've got to cry once it hits, and we would always miss, which is terrible for an actor. She was just kind of revving up for the tears, and then oh no. And we would keep the camera rolling, and it literally took probably about 20 times missing. And then when we finally hit her, I think that we were shooting with two cameras that day, so we were able to get like the authentic, real two angles at the same time. And we had the perfect hit, and we all knew it, mm-hmm. and she knew it, so she gave it, you know, and. So we did specifically give a lot of time to do that scene because it was important.
But at that scene where they're dancing in the parking lot, is any of that street traffic?
It's so funny. And when we're editing it, we'd be like, that person is not an extra. They're just watching the, and there would be continuity problems because people would stop by and you're not paying attention to the extras, right? So definitely, you know, unexpected people who showed up in that scene.
How long did it take to shoot that dancing?
Main dancing was a full day, and then I think that we did a little bit of it on the second day, but we shot at that location over 2 days.
He's really selling the screenwriting thing. In case anybody was thinking about it.
The thing is I've learned is to be a fighter, and I think that what you have to do is protect your vision at all stages of the game, because people are wanting to, you know, producers have a certain amount of money that they can spend, but sometimes you want to be more involved in like where it goes, because you have to protect what you've written, and sometimes you kind of lose your fight. And I think that what I've learned is like, no, fight for more time. Even on set, it's like, we didn't get it. I don't want to leave, and I don't want to be Kubrick, but at the same point, it's like you can't just rush something because you're going to have to deal with the problem in the editing room and it's not going to work. And then you're going to watch the movie and you're like, oh, that I wish we spent more time on that. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, I wouldn't say I'm passive, but I have this like irrational fear of being disliked. And I think for my next film, I just got to get rid of that and be an ass. But a good one, like a nice.
One thing though that you sort of like that you're proudest of how this all came out, like between the from the beginning to the end of this process for you.
You know, and I think this we made a film and everybody had a good time on set, and that is important to me. And I was able to protect actors from feeling too vulnerable. Because we were dealing with some bullying and you know, vulnerable material, and I think that everybody feels really proud of the film at the end of the day, especially Michelle, because I was really worried about her. I was really worried about the girl who would eventually play Irene because it was dealing with sensitive material. And no, she's been really great and really proud of the film. And I think that she really relates to it, and she thinks she's a great role model. Uh-huh. So I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of that she agrees with me.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan.
Finally, we wrap the show with the other Documentary Feature Audience Award winner from last year, Mr. Fish, Cartooning from the Deep End. The film follows adult-themed editorial cartoonist Mr. Fish as he navigates his often controversial profession during a time when the industry is on the way out. Film competition director Harrison Glazer spoke with Bryant, Mr. Fish, and Diana Day at the Alamo Drafthouse Village earlier this month. Mr. Fish trailer and clips courtesy of Gritty Film Productions and Next Bryant.
Do I want my art to be a threat to the dominant culture? Yes. Everybody can think differently, so therefore, everybody will think differently. So get used to it. Don't take it personally.
Like the kid in the back of the class who thought the teacher's full of shit, these other smartasses don't know what they're talking about. He's drawing some wild little cartoon, you know, mocking it all.
If he'd go out shopping or something, he'd leave me a little note to let me know where he was. I went for a walk. He's lying in a puddle of blood.
He is doing really what editorial cartoonists are meant to do. This guy has balls.
I think it's the responsibility of every artist to reflect the times in which they live. That's why Mr. Fish's work is really important.
It's not a dying profession. It is a profession that is being systematically murdered.
Well, the political situation continues to get more shit, and I've gotten more work. I think more and more people are starting to recognize, A, the importance of satire, and also starting to, you know, want to lend their voice to what's going on right now. They're looking for people like myself and other cartoonists that I know who do pull their punches. People are looking for ways to, vent their rage and their fury at what's going on. So all of a sudden, I'm relevant, essentially.
Well, let's take it back to the beginning. Pablo, what's your background and how did you come across Fish?
My background is I'm a camera operator. I've worked on other people's documentaries. I had been feeling for a long time before I started this film that I wanted to make something. Being inspired to make something, going, that's the film I want to make. It hadn't happened, you know. There had been ideas that had come and gone. But I heard him on the radio. I was in Los Angeles, I had no idea who he was. And I hear this guy talking about how he experiences each day as the five stages of grief, but in reverse. So he wakes up with acceptance for the world, and then he gets angry with the world, and then he tries to compromise with the world, and then in the end he goes to bed in denial, so he gets to sleep. And it really was just like, oh my God, that's how I experience the world. You know, you hear stuff on the news and you want to crawl up in your shell and you want to shake your fist at the sky and you go through all these emotions because some of it is just so intense and overwhelming and dark and that how do you deal with it? So he had this just beautifully succinct, funny, slightly heartbroken analogy, right? Mm-hmm. And then when I got his book of cartoons, they had all the same, they all had the same layers, you know, in a single panel cartoon. It'd be funny and sad and angry and then just like have all these things going on. Yeah. And I just was absolutely drawn to it like a magnet. And I just didn't look back. Once he said yes, that I could make a documentary about him, I was like, okay, we're going.
Yeah. Well, that was my next question is, Fish, why would you say yes to having some stranger follow you around and your family?
I didn't believe he was going to follow through. No, and that is true, but it's partially how I have to engage with my work anyway. You know, I don't care what people sort of think about me. I don't trust people's judgments of myself, and I'm willing to make mistakes in public. I don't know if you can tell, but I mean, a lot of my cartoons are just, it's usually my gut reaction. It's my first response either to how politics are, or any number of things, and sometimes, you know, it comes off as being severe, maybe a little too severe. So I'm just used to just like being very present-centered when I can, which I think is all the time to a fault, according, you know, I can talk to my wife about that. And so So yeah, it's just it's literally just like one moment to the next. So it's not like a thing where it's just like, oh, I'm going to try to imagine why this might be a problem with somebody filming me in my house and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as a cartoonist, you know, you assume that people are looking at your work. So you already feel like you're in the public eye.
Yeah.
In a critical way, usually, too.
Do you remember the pitch you gave, or do you guys remember, like, what was it that you said to convince them, or how did you describe what you wanted to make to make these guys get on board?
I found out that he was having a gallery showing in Los Angeles. I didn't know if he was going to be there, so I went. And I had, just based on his art, I was like, I want to make a film about this guy, right? I wasn't thinking like, I wonder if he's a good character on camera. I wonder how this guy comes off on camera. I wasn't even thinking of it. It was just the art, right? So, which is not like, that's like a bad rookie documentary filmmaker mistake. Like, you should think of who's this guy gonna be on camera, right? So I met him and I said, I think I want to make a documentary about you. I mean, it was almost that quick. And he said, okay.
Fish, what was it like seeing, I guess, like your life and your work packaged this way? Did it change the way you see your art or your work in any way? Did it give you a new perspective?
It gave me a perspective.
Yeah.
Because I don't really have one. Like I said, if I'm always trying to be very present-centered, I don't really have the ability to sort of have a sort of a global picture of what I do. And Pablo, a few times during the filming, as it was getting closer to completion, would ask me if I wanted to see any scenes or anything, and I was like, I don't want to see anything. And which what that did for me was when I finally did see the movie, I forgot practically the whole thing, like stuff that I didn't remember saying any of this stuff. So I was just like an audience member, which is like, wow, this is a real character, this guy. And so it was really fun. And as Pablo can tell you, I mean, he shot more footage than I think was shot for Let It Be, you know, for that documentary. I mean, there's so many hours that he has. So, I mean, whatever narrative line he was going to follow, I had absolutely no idea.
Neither did I.
What was that process, Pablo? Like, what kind of stuff did you leave on the cutting room floor? How did you find your story within all that footage?
The process initially was just film. For about 2 years, I think, I just filmed, and I didn't have a lot of direction. I mean, I was really looking, hoping that the story would sort of reveal itself to me and sort of like, okay, this is the film you want to make now. And after about a couple of years, I got a real deep, uneasy feeling in my gut, like, oh my God, I'm lost at sea, you know, and I don't know how to tell this story, and I don't know what it's going to be, and I don't know what the I'm doing, you know, in a way. There was some kind of pure instinct thing happening. And then when my editor came on board, we began to shape it.
You have some controversial stuff in here. Your work can be controversial, and you have young girls at home. You told me earlier that they finally got the chance to see the film. Can you talk about, I guess, what that was like and what their reaction was to what was on the screen?
apparently, well, gee, how do I even begin to talk about this? So I'm sitting there with my daughters, who are now 14, and it's coming up to the part where it's the 19-year-old self-portrait of me, like with the erection, right? And I couldn't even, I sort of like was a deer in the headlights, you know, all of a sudden. As soon as I see reaching in where I'm laughing before I take it out, there's no way to get the girls out in time. So of course I had to turn to them sitting right next to me, and I said, shield your eyes, shield your eyes. And Juna dutifully heard me say, and then she squished them like this. Dinah, on the other hand, heard shield your eyes and just give me a nod and then just did this. You know, and then we had a conversation afterwards, and they don't care.
Favorite animated cartoons that are current?
Bob's Burgers is fine. I mean, I'm critical of everything. It's such a hard question, you know, because I don't like anything. And I don't remember what I do. I think there's something wrong with me. Hertzfeld.
Yeah.
Don Hertzfeld.
Don Hertzfeld.
Austin Boyd done well.
Yeah, I think that he is really, really, really great. But as far as just like you know, an animated series or... I tend to be very, very critical because... To me, more and more art can only go through a corporation to get seen. So I always see where all the compromises are, and I hate compromises in art. And so I find myself hard pressed to see something and say, that is fantastic, because all I see are the compromise. I became interested in, this was 2004 or 5 probably, and I figured that I should probably get into animation, because I was just doing still single panel cartoons. And so I got a program that's called Toon Boom Studio. And it's a program that has very few shortcuts in it. So it relies on an animator to draw every single panel. You know, it's onion skinned. And that's what I wanted. I wanted something that was so labor intensive that it would make me want to kill myself. Because you can sort of see it in the end. You know, I think that you can see the depth of animation. Anything that has a lot of shortcuts in it, you might as well be saying, yes, I create, watercolors. But you take a picture and you put it in Photoshop and then you add the watercolor filter and it's like, yes, I'm a watercolorist. And I hate how easy things are. So I wanted to do something that was very painful. So I started doing that when I was working for the LA Weekly in the mid 2000s.
What does victory look like for you now?
I would say just more and more camaraderie and people recognizing the same, you know, the shit show that we're in, you know. And I think one way that I would put it is if we look at the culture and we assume that we are collectively drowning somehow, I think that satire and artists at one time, it was their job not to throw you a life preserver, which I think a lot of satire can do by creating you a joke. Real satire, it doesn't throw you a life preserver, it teaches you how to swim. And so that's always been my challenge to myself. It's not about like, okay, I'm going to turn mayhem into burlesque that we can then, you know, feel less threatened by it. I want to keep saying this is threatening and we've got to contribute to, changing the situation, because it actually takes all hands on deck. And I'm always worried when you have this celebrity personality that can speak eloquently about it, you know, address the issues in a pointed way, that all of a sudden gets everybody else off the hook because they're like, wow, I don't have that talent, I don't have that focus, so therefore I will remain a spectator and I will remain an audience member. And if that's the pattern, which I think it is for many circumstances that we find ourselves in now, nothing is going to change. It's going to keep people as spectators, and it's going to keep the very few that really want to just be unhappy for the rest of their lives because they're fighting the fight, continue to fight the fight and just be unhappy.
Did you script any of your scenes?
No, the couch was totally unscripted and I happened to have my camera at the right place at the right time. The parking lot was not scripted. I didn't tell him what to say. We had been talking about, I'm trying to remember exactly what the conversations were around that shot in the parking lot. I mean, we sort of talked loosely about content.
I feel like I'm just marking time, holding my breath a little bit until something happens. So it's fine-ish. In many ways, it's nice. It's nice to be reminded how things fit together, you know, how the hive works. It's humbling. I'm not tortured so much, but I do feel like it's like limbo, you know? I'm just in limbo right now. It's debilitating in the sense that it sort of slowly eats you alive.
I'm gonna get out of that fucking place. I need to go to California. You know what sucks about this place most? Is that I'm really good at it and that everybody's very nice. I used to be somebody who would get hate mail. I knew what I was doing then. I don't get any hate mail here.
What's the future of the political cartoon industry?
For America, it's in desperate straits. Yeah. And more, even the sites and the places where I publish are censoring me more and more.
Still.
Yeah, because people don't really know how to have the conversation. They don't. If you're having a difficult conversation, you should be given the opportunity to be wrong. And I think that there's more and more there's this push where it's just like, we can't have the controversy. You can't sort of figure out what you think in the public square anymore. So therefore, people just stop engaging. And that's what I'm coming, that's what I'm dealing with a lot now. And what's interesting is that I'm curating an exhibit for the University of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And the subject of the show is, it's basically the alternate underground press from the 1960s. And the reason it's with the University of Connecticut is they have a massive archive, tons of newspapers from that time. So I've been going up and going through their archive, and again, just like I say in the movie, it's just like I was born at the wrong time. Because these are newspapers that assume that the audience is grown up and can handle difficult conversation. And that's completely absent now. I think there's this illusion that because of the internet, we can have all of these conversations that can be nuanced, that can be all of these things. But really, that's not the public square. And it's deeply frustrating because, and I've talked about this before, it's. I used to watch The Daily Show all the time. I don't watch the new incarnation at all. I don't think I've seen maybe one or two episodes. But people would always tell me, satire's alive and well. Look at Jon Stewart, look at all this stuff that's going on. And I'm just like, that is true, sort of. Because what you're dealing with then, it's just like, he's got a massive audience. You know, they cite the numbers, millions and millions of people. But it's an audience made up of people in private situations that are isolated. It's not really an audience that's going to threaten the dominant culture or power structures, because you're in your house. You're laughing. You're not doing anything. So I think that one way to sort of to help turn the great ship around is to return this kind of political conversation, and all these needs to have deeper discussions about where the culture should be going in places where you can actually be in the presence of other human beings, because only when people are amassed do they congregate enough. Power to talk to powerful people in higher places. Nobody's going to listen to any administration is not going to listen to individuals. You need to create a giant.
Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Maya Perez, and Sonia Onescu. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.